It's a real delight to welcome our next instructor joining us here at European Investing Summit 2017. We have Jose Antonio Larraz, the founding partner of Ekwam Capital, who is here with us from Madrid, sharing with us his experience investing in the public markets with a private equity approach. Jose brings more than 20 years of asset management and private equity investment experience to the summit. More specifically, Jose founded Ekwam Capital in 2014, where he selectively invests in publicly traded companies that have both a sound business as well as a sound and solid financial structure at a discount to intrinsic value. Jose is leveraging 10 years of experience in private equity, where he had firsthand exposure to due diligence processes, structuring and the execution of transactions, drafting and negotiating transaction documentation, and ultimately he participated in 11 transactions. We are really honored that Jose has chosen to be here with us. I'm quite excited by what he has to share, and I look forward to learning from your comments.
Thank you very much for the nice introduction. Thank you very much for having this opportunity to present here on the European Investing Summit for the first time. So, as you have said in the introduction, here at Ekwam Capital, we are leveraging on our broad experience that both partners have in private equity. So we have been for more than 20 years investing in non-quoted companies. We have been participating in the board of directors of companies and helping management teams to develop their strategy and to create value throughout time. Obviously, when you invest in non-quoted companies, you are very much used to invest for the long run. So we typically were invested in companies for 6, 7 years or even more. All this experience, this is what we are now using by investing in the public markets. We believe this give us very good advantage because we think that in many occasions in the market, people are investing more thinking in the short term. If you are patient enough for the long run instead of trying to gain in the short term, then you can take advantage and make extraordinary investments. Just to give very briefly, I mean, when we try to look for an investment, we basically looking at four important criteria to identify good or investment opportunity. The first one is that we want to invest in good businesses, in stable businesses that have good visibility and as much as possible that have certain competitive advantages or barriers of entry. The second criteria that we have is that we want to invest in companies that have low risk. For us, the most important risk is debt. So basically, we want to avoid companies which have too much that could enter at some time in the future into financial difficulties. Then the third criteria would be that we want to invest in companies which are what we call owner-occupied, basically where we believe that the management is totally aligned with the rest of the shareholders and where there is a shareholder which has control or which at least has a long-term view. And finally, the last criteria is that in addition to all those criteria that we have mentioned before, we want to buy cheap, or if not cheap, at least at a reasonable valuation. Obviously, the perfect company does not exist. The perfect company that meets these four criteria perfectly is very difficult to find. But what we try to achieve is to find companies which have a very good balance between these four criteria. Obviously, we think what is difficult in the stock market is that every morning when you wake up, you have, if you are investing in Europe like us, maybe you have 4,000 companies that you can invest in. So the difficulty is to know where to find these companies that could meet this criteria. And we believe there are two big areas where you can find these opportunities. One is companies that are temporarily having problems because of the short-term view of the market that we mentioned before. The market is penalizing those. Normally, the market is overreacting. If you are patient enough and you look for the long run, willing to wait for 2, 3 years, then you can find a nice opportunity. And the second area where we normally find good opportunities is in companies that for whatever reason, the market is ignoring. Typically, this is because they are a small cap, or the market capitalization is small, or they are working in a small niche, or they are local companies working in a specific geographic area, and the market is not looking at it. The company we want to, and I'm going to present today, is a company that we believe meets quite well the four criteria that we have just mentioned. And this company is a company which is called Arcus. Arcus is a company which is based in Oslo, is a Norwegian company, which is basically a branded consumer goods company, and more specifically is selling wines and spirits in the Nordic countries. It is a company that has around 320 million euros of market capitalization. The company was created in 1996, and it was the spin-off from the retail monopolistic company in Norway, which is selling spirits and wine in the Nordic countries. And we will be explaining afterwards how is this working in the Nordic countries. The company was a state-owned company, and it was privatized in 2004. And soon after that, in 2005, the company was acquired by a private equity, a Nordic private equity, which is called Ratos. And once this private equity bought the company, they developed a very aggressive and growing strategy, putting this company, which was a Norwegian company working only on Norway for a reduced number of products, to become pan-Nordic company working in all Nordic countries with a full range of products within the spirits and wine segments. This allowed the company to grow very rapidly to become a clear market leader in the Nordic countries. Then in 2016, the company was listed in the Oslo Bourse through an IPO which included both. First, Ratos selling a great part of their stake in the company, and second, a capital increase where they injected around 775 million NOK to reduce debt, because obviously this was a private equity-owned company and it had quite a lot of leverage. And by doing this capital increase, the leverage of the company was reduced significantly from around 4 times net debt EBITDA to the current level of net debt EBITDA of 2.1 times. Basically, the company right now has around 2.5 billion NOK of revenues, which means around 275 million euros, and an EBITDA, this is 2016 numbers, of 335 million NOK, which is around 35 million euros in EBITDA. And the company had, at the end of 2016, 409 employees. So this is basically a little bit the description of the company. As I mentioned before, the company was listed at the end of 2016 at 44 euros per share, 43. And basically the share since then has not done much. So they are basically at the similar level at the one of the IPO. If we look at the business description, basically the company has 3 different businesses. The largest one in terms of revenues is the wine distribution business. The second one is the spirits distribution business. And these 2 businesses, the company operates in all Nordic countries and also a little bit in Germany, and we'll explain a little bit that later. And then they have a logistics distribution business, which is only operating in Norway. As you can see in the left upper side of this slide, the company is a clear market leader in the Nordic countries, and they held top 3 positions in most of the countries where they operate. In terms of the geographic breakdown, Norway and Sweden are the largest countries in terms of revenues, with around 40% each. Then they have a smaller presence in Finland, obviously because also Finland is a much smaller market than Norway and Sweden, and Denmark and Germany. And then what is very astonishing about this company, you look at the bottom right-hand side of this slide, is that Arcus has been able to grow for the last 12 years at a compound average growth rate of 11%, out of which 7% corresponds to organic growth, which is very remarkable, especially if we think the market in the Nordic countries for wine and spirits has not been growing so much, and the growth has been around 3-4%. So it has been really a very successful story, as I was saying before, from being a pure Norwegian company operating only in that country to a Nordic operator with top leading positions in most of the countries. So this is the business. Now, before going into more detail to describe the different business units and the investment rationale, it's very important to have a good understanding of how the retail distribution of wines and spirit is working and works in the Nordic countries, because it's completely different to any other European country that I know. I'm sure it's also extremely different to the US, and it will be a surprise for many people. And basically, the alcohol sales in Norway, Finland, and Sweden are all or mainly done through regulated state-owned retail monopolies. You can see from these three distribution channels, basically the Horeca, restaurants, and bars, duty-free, which are done in the airports, and the retail, 90% of the sales in these countries are done through these retail monopolies. Basically, there are one for each country. So one is Vin Monopolet for Norway. The other one is System Bolaget for Sweden. And then you have Alko for Finland. Basically, they work in a very similar way. Basically, you cannot buy wine or spirits outside these monopolies. You cannot go to a supermarket or to Carrefour or to whatever and try to buy wine or vodka, because you will not find that there. You have to go to these retail monopolies. And the second characteristic is that the advertising is whether prohibited, like in Norway, or if you are allowed to do advertising, is very restricted. So it's not that you can have a very strong competition in terms of advertising. Then the other characteristic is that in these retail monopolies, in order to access to that, they normally do tenders. So there is a tender process where they invite people to present their offer to sell, for example, vodka or to sell gin. You have to meet the criteria that they put in the tender. And then the monopolies, they do a selection based on certain experts that they have in-house, and they select which vodka they are going to put in the stores. So you have to go through this tenders process. And the good thing is that if you manage to get into this tender process, then you are guaranteed that you are going to be in the retail system of these monopolies and at an established price, and you are only going to compete with the others that will be winning that tender. So that limits competition in a certain way. It's true that this system may seem strange and unattractive to people outside the Nordics, but it is also true is that this has been working like this for many, many years, and it has a strong support from population. Basically, the objective from the point of view of the Nordic governments is that they want to regulate and ensure responsible sales of alcohol. So then, obviously, 90% of the sales are done through these retail monopolies. There is 10%, as we mentioned before, which is done through duty-free and restaurants and bars, basically the Horeca segment. Obviously, these two segments represent a small portion of the market, but it's true that they play an important role for brand building and also to establish a trendsetter for certain products and categories. So despite it's a small part of the business, it's also important for these two reasons that I have just mentioned. So having put in context how or where in which market Arcus is operating now, let's have a description of the three businesses that Arcus is operating in. The first one is the spirits business. And in the spirits business, as we saw before, in terms of revenue, it's around 30%. But in terms of EBITDA, it's quite similar to the wine business, because it has higher gross margins and therefore has higher EBITDA margin. Within the spirits business in Arcus, around 90% of their revenues are coming from their own products, which are produced in their plant in the surroundings of Oslo in Norway. And only 10% of the products that they are selling are agency products, which belong to third-party players. As you can see in this slide, they maintain very strong positions in all the markets, especially because they are the clear market leader in a product which is very specific to the Nordics, which is a spirit which is called Aquavit. They call the spirits of the Nordics. This spirit has a very broad and long root in the Nordic region. It's the liquor that they choose for holidays and special events. So it has a great part of the segment of spirits in the Nordics. Arcus has very, very strong market positions for this product. If you can see in this slide, for example, in Aquavit, in Norway, they have around 83% market share. In other markets, well, it changes between 60% and 30% by the string, clearly the market leader. This Aquavit spirit product is also quite popular in Germany, not in all Germany, but in the north part of Germany. That is what explains Arcus' presence in Germany. I mean, they are only selling Aquavit, which is a very specific product, but in that product, they have a market position, a leading market position in Germany. Another characteristic of the spirits business is that it's a quite concentrated market in the Nordics. So you have very few players, which in total, they have the great majority of the market. As you can see, I mean, the other competitors are, on one side, they are large international companies like Pernod Ricard or Diageo. On the other side, they are local companies, especially one company which is called Altia. And Altia is a company very similar to Arcus, but in Finland. So Altia was basically the spin-off of Alko, which is the monopoly in the Finnish market. And it's a similar company to Arcus. So quite concentrated market, few players, and very strong position of Arcus, especially because of their great presence in Aquavit. Obviously, they also sell other spirit products like cognac, bitter, or vodka, but I mean, obviously, because it's important for them to have the full product range. In terms of the development of the spirits business in the Nordic countries, this is a segment which is not growing very much, it's not growing rapidly, not growing at all in volumes, pretty stable. But it's also true that there's been a trend in recent years of premium. Basically, people are willing to consume less, but to consume better products. And that has allowed that despite the stability in volumes or slight decline in volumes, the development in terms of value has been good. The sector has been growing between 2-3%. And also, within all the spirits segment, the Aquavit product has been performing much better than other products because Aquavit some years ago, I mean, 10, 15, or 20 years ago, was mainly consumed during the Christmas period or some festivities. But now it's more and more consumed throughout all the year, and not only in special occasions. So that has allowed this product has been growing faster than other products. So this is the spirits business here. You can see also the business development of the spirits segment. It's true that 2015 was a bad year for the company in this segment. They had some problems where they had to do a special promotion for certain products, which eroded the profitability. And they also had an interruption of products, I mean, of a business that they were selling some brands of vodka in the US, which was out of their core business, and they decided to interrupt that business, and that explains the fall in 2015. In 2016, the company already recovered that, and as you can see, the margins were back to normal levels. So basically, this is the spirit business. Then the second business where the company is operating is the wine business. The wine business shares some characteristics to the other business because it's also sold through the monopolies, but it has also important differences regarding the spirit business. The first important difference is that whereas we were saying that the spirit business is quite stable and not growing so much, in the case of the wine business, the consumption in the Nordic countries, the consumption per capita, has been and is continuing increasing in quite significantly. It's a segment which has pretty much strong growth. It's also true that it's coming from low levels compared to other European countries because the consumption per capita used to be very low, and that allows to have good growth in the segment. Then the second characteristic is that whereas in the spirits, the products are quite stable and the brands that don't change so much, in the case of the wine, and obviously because you don't have any production of wine in the Nordics for obvious reasons, but you are selling products which are coming from all parts of the world, so Europe, US, Australia, etc. So the life cycle of these products is much shorter because you have so many products to sell and the tendencies and the modes are very different. So consumers are always looking to try something new, and that makes the product doesn't stay for too long in or for many years as the most popular. They tend to change quite a lot. The third characteristic important in wine is that whereas in the spirit business, we were mentioning that it is quite concentrated segment where few players having the great bulk of the market, in the wine business, it is much more fragmented. It's also much more fragmented for the reason that we were mentioning before, because you have much more products and different geographical areas where you can get wine, and also because the life cycle of the product is much shorter. So you have certain periods where you have the Chilean vini wine that is more demanded, then you go to the Spanish wines, etc. So that makes that the market is much more fragmented. In any case, the Arcus position in the market is also very strong, as in the case of spirits. Differently to the spirit business, in the wine business, Arcus is only concentrated in three markets, basically Norway, Sweden, and Finland. So it's only operating in those businesses where we do have these retail monopolies that we described before. So they have top three positions in the three markets, and the kind of competitors that you have in this market is also very similar to the spirit. So you also have Altia that we mentioned before, which you have Pernod Ricard and some other local competitors. If you look to the performance of this business segment in recent years, I mean, you can see there has been quite a strong top line growth. As we were mentioning, this is an area segment which is growing. You can see that there has been certain erosion in the margins. And we will be talking about that later, but basically the company has been affected by the depreciation of the local currencies. Basically, obviously, they are importing products which they buy in euros or US dollars. They are selling in local currencies. This evolvement of the local currencies has made that there has been certain erosion in the margins. And then what is interesting in the wine business is the way the company is operating, because they have a decentralized and entrepreneurial business model where basically the company has a large number of subsidiaries which are led by one entrepreneur. And typically one of these entrepreneurs, they have contacts with local producers in one particular geographical area. They are selling their products in the Nordic countries together with Arcus. So they are leveraging on the close relationships of Arcus with the monopolies. Arcus is benefiting from the strong knowledge of the local producers that these entrepreneurs have. So there is a strong alignment of interest. These entrepreneurs have a small stake in each of the subsidiaries. So there is this alignment of interest that assures the long-term commitment of the entrepreneurs. And this system and this structure allows to maximize the presence of Arcus in the different tenders, because it is the case that, for example, in some of the tenders for a particular wine, you could have two or three subsidiaries of Arcus which are competing each against other. But this is good for Arcus because they maximize the possibility that they will be the selected and the winner in a particular tender. So in the case of the wine business, and differently to the spirit business, most the great part of the products are sold with the brand of the local producer. They are selling third-party products. But they also have a business of certain wine products which they are selling with their own brands, which are they are producing in the local factory that the company has in Oslo. So basically, they buy wine in bulk, or they develop together with a local producer to adapt that product to the characteristics of the Nordic countries. And then they bottle that wine in Norway, and they sell it in the Nordics. This is particularly true in Norway, because in Norway, it is very popular, this bag-in-box wine, which is basically a box with capacity of 3 liters where they put the wine and they sell it. And this is very popular, and this is an area where Arcus has been developing and has been very successful in Norway, achieving quite important growth. So this is basically the wine business. The third business is the logistics business. This is the smaller business, and this is a business that is only operating in Norway. So basically, this segment, the company is providing logistics services, first internally, obviously, for Arcus, but also for third-party players for the Norwegian market. And this business, which is small, but they had some difficulties from 2012 when they built a new manufacturing plant. In the transfer from the old plant to the new one, they had some problems, and the service, the quality of the service, deteriorated quite significantly, and that made some customers to interrupt working with Arcus. They started having important losses on this business, as you can see in the bottom part of this slide. For the last few years, the management has been working pretty hard to turn around this business, basically making a strong cost reduction program and also winning back the trust of customers. Obviously, this takes time and it's slow, but the company has been improving quite a lot. Last year, in 2016, they finally reached the break-even of the business. The objective of the company is to achieve at least 5 to 7% EBITDA margin in the coming years. So this is the description of the three business of the company. Now let's move to why we believe this is a good investment opportunity. So we strongly believe that there are very strong merits for this company. The first one is that this company is operating in a very attractive market. It's a non-cyclical market. It's an stable market in the case of the spirits and a growing market in the case of wine. It's a business which has quite a lot of visibility. In addition to that, as we have mentioned, the companies are operating in a market where, as we have described before, there is a monopoly in the system. This allows a strong market position companies like Arcus to benefit from this because of the close relationships that they have with the monopolies, which makes small companies to gain market share and also for new entrants to come into this market. Related to that, obviously, there are important barriers of entry. Also, the fact that, as we mentioned before, you cannot do advertising. And the fact that once you are or you enter in the tender and you are within the assortment of the monopoly, as long as the sales are performing well, you are going to be selling through the monopoly without problem for many time. And so that creates certain barriers of entry. Then another important aspect that we haven't mentioned is that the company, in addition to the organic growth that they have achieved throughout years, they have constantly been doing bolt-on acquisitions. And these bolt-on acquisitions create a lot of value because Arcus is the perfect platform for these acquisitions. First, they are buying small companies or small brands, and they normally are able to buy those at attractive prices. Second, once they integrate these small acquisitions in their platform, they can leverage on the strong presence that Arcus have in the different geographical markets. And this creates a lot of value. In this slide, for example, we have some of the recent acquisitions that they have been doing. The last one was a vodka brand that is called Duorek. Basically, this vodka was produced in another plant, and what they did is they closed the factory and they moved the production of this vodka to their own factory, allowing them to create quite a lot of operational leverage. And precisely, this is another of the merits of this company, is that they have a very strong operational leverage. In 2012, the company invested 1 billion NOK in a completely new factory, which includes the bottling and the manufacturing of the spirits, and also it has the distribution business. This plant is currently at around 60% capacity. So any growth and any additional volume that you put in this plant has a tremendous impact on the profitability of the company because of the high operational leverage. And the other important thing is that because of the large investment that they did some years ago, the current investment level of the company is extremely low. So they have a maintenance capex of around 20 million NOK per year, whereas they have a depreciation level of around 50 million. So the company, and this is the other point, has a very strong cash flow generation capacity. Basically, first, because as we mentioned, they hardly have to do any capex. Second, obviously, because the company generates important margins and has low capital needs, so the return on capital is very high. And third, which is also important, because the working capital needs of the company are very low. Basically, this is due because they are collecting the taxes from the spirits, because as you can imagine, there is a strong tax on this kind of product. So 70% of the retail final price is taxes. And these taxes are collected by Arcus. And they are benefiting from that because they are getting paid by the monopolies before they have to give the taxes back to the authorities. So basically, they hardly have any working capital. So the combination of low capex, low working capital needs, and high return on capital business and high margins makes that the company is generating an extraordinary amount of cash flow. So basically, we believe this is a very attractive business. And what is more important is that we believe we can buy a very attractive business at a very attractive, or at least we consider it a very attractive valuation. Currently, Arcus is trading at 8% free cash flow yield, 2017, and we believe this is cheap for a company with the strong investment merits that we just mentioned. We, on absolute terms, we believe that a company like this should be trading more on at around 6% free cash flow yield, which basically would mean that there is a 30% upside to the current price. And we don't like very much to look to comparables, but if you look to other companies which have a similar business model, you can see that basically they are trading at around 4 or 5% free cash flow yield. We don't believe that because, for example, Pernod Ricard or Diageo, obviously they are much better companies and they are very international and they have higher margins. So we don't believe that 4% free cash flow yield is reasonable for this company. But we strongly believe that 6% should be a normal level for Arcus. And that's why we believe there's a 30% potential on the current situation. But in addition to that, we should take into account that this has been a company which has been growing significantly throughout many years. The management team has put in place certain financial targets for the coming years, which we believe they are very reasonable. We compare them with the historical levels, not the historical levels for the last 10, 12 years, but the historical levels of the company in the last 3, 4 years. Even if we consider that they will not be able to achieve these financial targets, and taking some more conservative assumptions, like the ones we are showing in this slide, we still believe that if we are patient and we wait for 3, 4 years, the potential upside of this opportunity is much higher, and that we could be getting an investment return compound average annual reinvestment return of around 18 to 20% in the next 3, 4 years. So this is the kind of returns that we expect for this investment. Obviously, as always, there is always risk and things that can go wrong. We have put in this slide some of the risks. I think the most important ones, the two ones that we put at the beginning. First, obviously, if there is a change in regulation, if there is an increase of taxes, or if they decide to interrupt the monopolies system that there is in the Nordic countries, some of the advantages that Arcus has would disappear. However, we believe this is very unlikely. I mean, this monopoly system has been working in the Nordic countries for many years and is working well. And as I was mentioning before, there is a strong support from population. So there is no incentive from the government to change the system because it's working well. Then the second big risk would be the currency risk. When we saw the big wine business, we saw that obviously because of deterioration of the NOK and the other local currencies, the margins of the wine business has been suffering. There is the risk that there continues to be a deterioration, then margins will continue suffering. But it's also true that we see that more as an upside right now because the current local Nordic currencies are at historical low levels, and we believe that this should be recovering in coming years, and this should allow to improve margins in the wine business. Then obviously other risks that we mentioned, there are key people leaving the company, especially we mentioned before all the entrepreneurs that there is in the wine business, but it's also true that the company does not depend on any particular person. So I think this risk is not as high as the other ones. Another risk that is important is they operate from one only plant, which is in the surroundings of Oslo. So should there be any problem with that plant, there would be an interruption of production, and temporarily there would be some problem for the company. Finally, obviously, this business, which we said is quite stable throughout time, is seasonal because obviously it's quite strong in the fourth quarter around the Christmas period. But we believe this is not such a big problem like in a retail business where there is more uncertainty whether the current collection this year will be working well or not. In this case, I mean, the business is much more stable, so we don't see that this is such a big risk. So finally, to conclude, basically, we believe that Arcus is a nice opportunity because it meets the criteria that we are looking for good investments. First, it's an investment which we believe is under the radar. The company has been recently quoted at the end of 2016 and is currently only covered by two local brokers in the Nordic countries. So it's not very well known by the market. Second, it's a good business, high return on capital employed, stable demand, low cyclicality, high barriers of entry and low capital needs. So it's an attractive business and it has 2x net debt EBITDA. I mean, it's not very, very low, but considering the strong cash flow generation capacity of the company, we believe it's very reasonable. Regarding owner occupied, I mean, it's true that the management has not a great participation in the company, but the good thing that we believe is that following the IPO and when the private equity sold, two new investors came into the company, and one of them is a Norwegian citizen, which is called Erik Hagen, and he is the chairman of another branded consumer goods company, which is called Orkla, and he's an entrepreneur and long-term investor. And there is another investor which took a 9% in the company, which is John Fredriksen, which is also a Norwegian citizen, which is an entrepreneur in the oil industry. And we feel comfortable that these two entrepreneurs, long-term view investors, the majority shareholders of the company, and we are together with them. So we feel comfortable regarding this. And finally, as we mentioned before, this is a company which we think that for the good characteristics that the business has, is trading at a very attractive free cash flow yield, around 8%. So the company meets our investment checklist, and we believe this is a good opportunity.
If we turn to slide number 3, I noticed that the company previously was owned by private equity. Could you please elaborate why they chose to IPO as opposed to perhaps selling to a strategic owner?
So basically, I mean, the Ratos private equity had been in the company for 11 years, and after a very successful strategy, it was time for them to exit. I don't really know why they choose the IPO. Probably this is a question for them, so it's difficult to answer from the outside. I haven't contacted them, but I guess that they tried to sell it to also to industrial players, and maybe there was not so much interest in the business, so they thought that they could maximize the proceeds through the IPO. But I'm not sure about this, for sure.
You also mentioned that John Fredriksen has become a public shareholder, which I think is very, very interesting. John Fredriksen has a history of remarkable value creation. Do you know if John Fredriksen perhaps might be involved with financial engineering, maybe helping to unlock the earnings power or the valuation discrepancy?
I'm not sure. What I do know is that, at least for the moment, he's not in the board of directors of the company. So for the time being, he has a more passive attitude regarding this investment. On the contrary, the other larger shareholder, which is Mr. Hagen, which I mentioned, which is the chairman of Orkla, he has a much larger stake in the company, a 33% versus the 9% of John Fredriksen, and he is in the board of directors, so he has taken a more active position in the company. In any case, as I mentioned during the presentation, we feel very comfortable that these two very successful entrepreneurs, they have decided to enter into Arcus, and we like that very much, and this is one of the merits of Arcus, at least for us.
If we please look at slide number 4, I'm looking at the segment mix. Do you have any thoughts how the segment mix might look in 3, 5, 10 years from now?
Well, basically, I mean, I don't think it will be very different in terms of geographic breakdown, but it's also true that management has commented to us that Finland is a nice opportunity for them because their presence in that country is not so big and that market is growing more than the others. So it might be that in 3-4 years, the Finnish business might be a little bit bigger than now. But obviously, I mean, Finland is what it is, so it cannot become 40% of the business because the country is not so big and the population is smaller than the other countries. So there might be some small changes, but I don't think it will look very differently. In terms of business segments, the wines and spirits, I mean, obviously wine is growing quicker than spirits, so probably we could see a greater part of the business coming from the wine business. But again, I mean, that wouldn't be a very significant change. So probably maybe they move from 60% to 65 or 70% or something like that. But in any case, it's also true that the spirit business has a higher margin. So in terms of EBITDA, the changes will not be significant either.
Turning to slide number 5, this is my first time learning about Nordic monopolies. How could people learn more? Are there any books, any resources?
Yeah, I haven't seen any books, but all these monopolies, they have their own websites, and there is quite a lot of information on those websites where you can look at it and get information on them. Also, the prospectus of the IPO of Arcus includes quite a lot of information on how these monopolies work. Because, as we mentioned in the presentation, I mean, it's very special and obviously very, very different to any other country in the world. So, yes, it's a very interesting story. And in the case of Arcus, it's something that we think is a strength because that allows them to have this strong market position and also to benefit from certain barriers of entry. So, yes, very interesting.
I'm looking at slide number 6, and I'm looking at the other players' data. And is it appropriate to think that the margins of Altia Diageo might be relevant in this situation over time?
If you look to Pernod Ricard Diageo, the margins are much higher. But obviously, Pernod and Diageo, they are very, very, very large companies. And if we look to the margins, we don't have a disclosure of which kind of margins they are getting in the Nordic countries. So it's difficult to make a comparison. In the case of Altia, I mean, as I mentioned before, this is a Finnish company which has a similar business model, and the margins are lower, but it's also true that the market position of this company is not as important as in the case of Arcus, and especially because Arcus has this position on Aquavit. So basically, Arcus, I think, is more or less in the middle between the large international players and some local players which have lower margins but also lower market position.
If we please turn to slide number 9.
Yes.
I'm noticing that the margins of the wine have not recovered since 2013, whereas the margins of the spirit business apparently did recover. Could you elaborate why one segment had a recovery and the other one is yet to improve?
In the case of the spirit business, 90% of the products that they sell are own products, which they are manufacturing in their own plant in Norway. So they do not have any exposure to currency risk. And in the case of the wine business, it is not the case because 90% of the business is coming from third-party products which are bought in other countries and they are bought in euros and dollars. And obviously, they buy in euros and dollars, but they sell in the local currency. And there's been a strong deterioration of the currencies in Nordic currencies in recent years, and that explains why the margins of the wine business has been deteriorating. Obviously, I mean, we believe that we are in historical minimum levels of the currencies. There could be some further deterioration in the future, but we see this more as an upside because all this deterioration of the Nordic currencies has been related to oil prices. I mean, these are economies which, especially Norway, which are very related to the oil. And because of the oil price reduction, the NOK has been deteriorating significantly. And obviously, this explains the deterioration of the margin in the wine business.
If you could please turn to slide number 10. I'd love to ask where you got this data from and how we could explore this data in more detail. What's the source and any other information about this?
This is coming from the prospectus of the IPO. It's very detailed how this business structure is executed at Arcus. And it's very interesting, as you were saying, it's very important because it explains the success of Arcus in the wine business. And it's a business model that is working very well, but it also allows the company to grow significantly in the future because as long as they are able to find new entrepreneurs that they want to join the company, they can continue putting more products into their product portfolio and being more able to succeed in the different tenders of the monopolies. And when we last talked to the management team, they explained us, like, in the recent months, they had two new entrepreneurs that were joining two new subsidiaries and putting new products into the portfolio. And, for example, one of the entrepreneurs that joined Arcus, he was a former employee of one of the monopolies, the Norwegian monopoly. So he knew very well what the needs of the monopoly were. And he also had some contacts on Chile, in this case, with some Chilean manufacturers. So joining Arcus, the platform, to be able to sell these products into the monopoly system. And so this is a model which is very attractive for Arcus and explains the good success of the wine business.
If we could please turn to slide number 11. I believe you mentioned that there have been some operating difficulties and some customers left. I'm curious if it's public information where these customers went. And I'm guessing you might not know, but I'd like to ask the question, who might have gained the market share?
There are two other players in the logistic business which are competing with Vectura, and they went to these other competitors. And obviously, it has been difficult years for Arcus in this business, but the good thing is that after some years and some hard work from the company, they are starting to gain and recover the trust from the customers. And obviously, this is a volume business, because once you have the infrastructure that Arcus has, any volume, additional volume that you put, is margin. So for the time being, they've been able to recover the break-even point. But management is quite confident that in the coming years, with some additional customers, they should be in this 5-7 EBITDA margin that the company is targeting for. And this is one of the areas where we believe the company can create value.
If we could please turn to slide 13.
Yes.
I noticed the language in the first bullet point, difficult to launch new brands because marketing is forbidden. Do you think that there's a risk that it's easier to create brands in an era of social media?
It might be the case, especially for the young people, no? And this is a way that they could avoid this limitation on advertising. But I think that would be a long-term trend. And in any case, I mean, it's Norway where the advertising is completely prohibited. In the case of Sweden and Finland, you still can continue to do advertising. And so it's not that it's completely prohibited. And also, it's true that you can use Twitter and other social media, but Arcus can actively use those. So yes, I mean, it's kind of danger, but I think it's a long-term danger that it will take time to pursue.
I thought slide 14 was very interesting. The third bullet point mentioned spare capacity to improve margins. Any further elaboration? This could be quite meaningful, perhaps.
Well, yes. Basically, I mean, obviously they need to grow organically, but as we have seen in the case of spirits, this doesn't go very quickly in terms of volumes, so it's difficult. So for them, the most important thing is to find these bolt-on acquisitions. In the previous slide, in the 13, I put some examples of recent acquisitions that they have done, and this is bringing additional volume. But talking to management, obviously, these bold acquisitions, they come when they come. I mean, you might have 2-3 years without any acquisition because the opportunity doesn't come through, and then suddenly 1 year it comes. So as long as they are able to find some opportunities, and the case of this vodka that I mentioned before, Dvorak vodka, that was a very good example because it was like 1.6 million liters additional capacity. They bought this brand, they closed the factory, which was somewhere else, and they brought this capacity to their plant, and that allowed them to have a huge and a very interesting operational leverage. But, I mean, you never know when these bolt-on acquisitions are coming. There are opportunities in the market. There are many small brands in the market which could be bought, but you just need to be patient for the right time to come. Because, obviously, what also management doesn't want to do is to buy anything at whatever price, because that doesn't make sense. So they want to be patient and buy the correct opportunity at the right price.
And I believe you also mentioned taxes when discussing slide 14. Any thoughts on why the tax rate should not change over time?
Well, I mean, something it could be increased. So yes, it could be the case, but I mean, it's also true they are already very high. I mean, I mentioned before that 70% of the retail price is already taxes. I mean, yes, that's one of the risks that they could increase, and I put it in the investment risk stage, but I don't think they will be going much further. And in any case, also, as we mentioned, in the case of spirits, there is a premiumization, so people are willing to, and it's not that they are willing to pay more, but they are looking for better products. And sometimes something which is more expensive looks like a better product, and you are willing to buy that because you want to share that in a special dinner with your friends, and you bought this Aquavit, which is 50 euros the bottle, and you saw against your friends, so you're happy. And I think that risk on the taxes is limited.
I'm looking at slide number 15. Yes. I'm noticing there's also a confectionery chocolate products manufacturing company with a 6.9%.
Yes.
That also seems to be interesting. I'm wondering if there's a reason why you chose not to talk about that. Maybe it's worth looking at separately.
Yeah, I mean, it's also an interesting company. I mean, we haven't got very much detail onto that company, but even if you compare that company with Arcus, it's trading more expensive because they are only at 7% free cash flow yield, whereas Arcus is at 8% free cash flow yield. And also the thing is, there is no monopoly on selling chocolate products, so this company does not benefit from the barriers of entry that Arcus has because of the monopoly situation. So yes, it's interesting business, interesting company, but it's a bit more expensive, and we believe less barriers of entry or less market leader position in the case of Arcus.
Turning to slide number 16, the financial targets and assumptions.
Yes.
I'd love to, again, understand how you came up with these assumptions. They seem to be a bit conservative or on the lower side. Any thoughts on how you chose these numbers?
Yes, wanted to do some numbers, being very conservative, being not only on the lower side, but below the management targets. And just to show there that even if the company is not able to go above those numbers that we put there, the investment return in this company would be very attractive because those numbers there that we put, the EQAM assumptions, we get annual investment return in the 18 to 20% range. Obviously, I mean, we get that valuing the company at the 6% free cash flow yield that we are assuming in the previous slide. If you put the 8%, then the returns would be lower. But we strongly consider that a company like this should be valued more at the 6% level than at the 8% level.
I'm wondering, is there any place for share buyback, or in this case, dividends truly are the way going forward?
So far, the company is not open to do share buybacks. First, they want to reduce a little bit the current leverage. They are 2.1. I mean, it's not very high, but they want to reduce debt, and they want to pay dividends. And also, as we mentioned before, they want to dedicate cash flow, if possible, to bolt-on acquisitions. In the priorities, it's not the share buyback. But talking to management, I mean, they don't discard that in the future, if they don't have any bolt-on acquisitions, and once they have reduced a little bit more the current leverage, they could be doing share buybacks. But it's not on the agenda of the management team right now.
And looking at slide number 18,
yes,
I'm noticing that there's low leverage. As you mentioned, the balance sheet is very safe. Why doesn't a private equity company buy it again?
Good question. It would be very nice if they buy them at a premium. We would be very happy. But I don't know if that's a possibility. I mean, this is a perfect target for a private equity, and Ratos did it very well, and probably that could be an opportunity. It's also true, and that's related to one of your questions, that they did an IPO and they didn't sell to another player, private equity or strategic, so maybe there was no appetite. I don't know why, but maybe there was no appetite. But yes, this is the kind of company that a private equity would be very happy to buy, and because of the strong cash flow generation capacity of the company.
If you could please turn to slide number 19, the final slide. I would guess that the balance sheet over time gets more valuable. The value of spirits and wine appreciates as opposed to depreciates. So perhaps the balance sheet might be understated. Do you have any thoughts if this might be the case? And if so, what the balance sheet might be worth on a fair market value?
You mean on the inventory that they have?
Correct. As wine ages, it's worth more, I assume.
Maybe that could be the case. In any case, it's not a huge amount that they have on inventory. So even if that's valuable much more, I don't think it has a big impact on the valuation of the company. So this is inventory that you are selling constantly.
Say, it's so wonderful to learn from you and to gain from your experience and your perspective and the way you see the world. I'd like to ask, why are you giving us so much of your time and so much of your wisdom? What's motivating you to share?
We love to share our investment ideas because we like to contrast that with other people which have different experiences and who have different ways to approach to the investment in the stock market. So in that sense, we are very happy to present this idea here together with you. And we would love a lot to hear from the audience and receive questions or receive comments or receive different point of views that could enrich and help us improve our investment process.
What kind of questions or feedback would be most helpful to you?
Well, if anybody has any different point of view on the investment merit or has seen any risk that we haven't included in the presentation or doesn't agree with the valuation or approach that we have, that would be very useful for us because obviously that would help us to get to know things that we haven't thought about maybe. So anything will be very welcome.
So I'm seeing we have a telephone number, a website. What's the best way to contact you?
Telephone, email, both of them. We are very happy to receive feedback and to be in contact with others.
Once again, it is really an honor to learn from you. It is so great to truly understand how you see the world and benefit from your decades of experience. Thank you for being here with us, and we hope to see you back in the future.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.